Ernest Greening was a man of great integrity. He was forceful and logical in all of his opinions. He fought for what he believed in, and his unlimited efforts were for others and never for his own personal gain. His life and his work and the things that he did for the state of Alaska and for the United States will long be remembered.
Alaska's flag at half-mast, a commemoration of Ernest Greening. With this special program, we hope to bring about the prediction of Mac McCarthy that the achievements and contributions of Ernest Greening will long be remembered. The program recalls the highlights of a man who came here as a reluctant carpetbagger in 1936 and actively served the state for the next 32 years. Greening was a doctor by education, a journalist by profession, a federal administrator by appointment before he came to Alaska for the first time. His direct contributions to our state began at an age, 49, when many public servants are already eligible for retirement. But this program commemorates Greening, not praises him. For the next 1 hour, we will hear Greening's own words, and we will hear others tell about him. We do not intend to flatter the man. He needs no flattery. But to tell others about him and to remind ourselves of the heritage he has left us. Greening needs no tribute, but we as Alaskans need to pay tribute to him for our own good and not for his. To be an Alaskan requires knowing about Alaska, and knowing about Alaska requires knowing about Greening. What we have, we should share with our fellow Alaskans, including those who came here since 1968. That's the year Greening retired from formal service to Alaska. He left this service as he began it, involuntarily. This, then, is the purpose of the commemoration of Ernest Greening, not to praise, but to learn. Please listen, then, as his fellow Alaskans and Ernest Greening himself tell you something about the man we celebrate today. Ernest Greening, February 6, 1887, to June 26, 1974. I'm not going to deluge you with facts about Greening. You can read about these facts better than I can tell you about them. I will touch on the highlights just enough to do two things. First, to whet your appetite to learn more about this remarkable man, and second, to place in perspective what others tell you about him in this program. Ernest Greening was not born in Alaska. He was not even born in a log cabin. In fact, he was born in a milieu about as far removed from Alaska as you can get in the United States, namely New York City. Ernest was the only son of Dr. Emil Greening, a Prussian-born eye and ear specialist. Greening Sr. used to joke that the eye specialists would praise him for being an ear specialist, and the ear specialists would say he was one of the best eye specialists. Still, the father reached some prominence in his field, and enough wealth to bring young Ernest and his sisters the advantages of travel and schooling overseas. Ernest stayed in French schools long enough to learn French, and in Germany long enough to apply the German he learned from his family. When Ernest and his four sisters did go to school in the United States, they went to rather exclusive private schools. Ernest, for example, went to the Hotchkiss School in Lakeville, Connecticut, from there to Harvard University. Upon graduation, he decided to follow his father's medical career. In his last year of medical school, also at Harvard, Ernest said he began to wonder if a medical career would interfere with his wide reading interests. Feeling that the career of a specialist would confine him, Greening asked his journalist friends and acquaintances for advice. They told him to study medicine. One told him journalists simply was a title for a newspaper man out of work. Greening nevertheless tried to study journalism for a few months. He put it into practice and a job which he held between graduation from Harvard Medical School and the period of internship which was to begin the following fall. That internship period never came. Dr. Ernest Greening never practiced medicine for a living. The summer job in the Boston Herald Traveler led to a 21-year career as a reporter, editor, and managing editor. As Greening tells it in his autobiography, Many Battles, he played the role of crusading journalist. According to Greening, he fought a number of his many battles with editors and later with publishers who wanted to suppress stories that would offend large contributors and advertisers or would lose circulation. Greening's unswerving principles, according to Greening, led him to the Boston Journal, the Portland Evening News, which he founded in Maine, and the New York Post and the New York Tribune. He also wrote for The Nation. As early as 1912, he wrote an editorial against laws which banned information about birth control. Although his boss stopped the presses and aborted the editorial, Greening continued to maintain that, in his words, a newspaper is a public trust. It owes an inviolable obligation to its readers. It cannot be just a business enterprise. It must be an instrument of public service. An advertiser does not buy special privileges in the news or editorial columns. Greening's involvement in political issues, he supported civil rights for women and for blacks, gradually led him further into politics. In 1928, he supported the candidacy of Alfred E. Smith for president. Still later, he urged Fiorello LaGuardia to run as mayor of New York. According to Greening, LaGuardia was at first reluctant to run for this office. Greening's crusades for social justice did not end at the borders of the United States. Listen now to the words of Ernest Greening.
My first interest came in the teens when I was managing editor of a magazine in New York called The Nation, and I was somewhat disturbed about the gunboat diplomacy which we were carrying on in Latin America, sending Marines into Haiti and Dominican Republic and Nicaragua and intervening in other countries. And I somewhat crusaded for this and got a senatorial investigation as to the Marine occupation of Haiti and Dominican Republic, which had been carried on under strict censorship, and which struck me as somewhat in conflict with Woodrow Wilson's pronouncement about self-determination of small nations. And then subsequently, the Harding administration failed to give recognition to the Obregon administration, Mexico, which was the first post-revolutionary administration, and it seemed to us an excellent one, and we took the position that there should be a more sympathetic understanding of the Mexican Revolution. And as a result of that, I was sent to Mexico, both by The Nation and Collier's, to write some articles, which I did, and they were published. But coming down there, I found that as late as 1923, nothing had been published between covers about the Mexican Revolution, and I conceived the idea of writing a book, which I started to do and which lasted several years because, of course, I couldn't afford to stay in Mexico continuously, so I had to go back and forth. And the book called Mexico and Its Heritage finally appeared in 1928. And believe it or not, it's still in print and is pretty well esteemed in Mexico. They like it, and it's considered the standard work, more or less, on Mexico. Well, as a result of that, when the Roosevelt administration came in, I was asked to be the advisor to the United States delegation to the 7th Inter-American Conference at Montevideo, which was President Roosevelt's first venture into foreign relations in the Latin American field. And in that conference, we sought to establish the good neighbor policy, and indeed we did. And we abjured intervention. We made the Monroe Doctrine more or less a joint concern. Sometimes we wonder today whether that was wise, but anyhow, it seemed wise at the time. And we recommended the lifting of the Platt Amendment for Cuba. That, again, in retrospect, sometimes circumstances alter situations. But anyhow, at that time, that seemed the wise thing to do, and that's what we did.
Greening stayed in the Roosevelt administration in another job, which brought him not only to the tropics, but also to Alaska.
My first connection with this area was on September 15, 1934, when I was about to be appointed director of a new agency in the Interior Department, the Division of Territories and Island Possessions. This was created by executive order of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, with a view to assisting our outlying and dependent areas which had no voting representation in the Congress. To brief me on his policies and purposes for these areas, which then included Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and until their independence, the Philippines, President Roosevelt called me to his residence at Hyde Park, New York, on the Hudson. He said to me then that he wanted me to arrange to have perhaps 1,000 people from the drought-stricken agricultural areas in the states move to Alaska. Alaska needs more people, he said, and we should do what we can to stimulate agriculture there and also give these farmers a chance to start life anew.
We've had many struggles here in Alaska through the years carrying out that assignment.
In his job as director of the Division of Territories and Island Possessions, Greening worked for, under, and sometimes against the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes. In Puerto Rico, Greening urged that a Puerto Rican govern the island, while Ickes wanted a mainlander. Greening urged that Puerto Ricans decide either statehood or independence. At times he clashed with Luis Muñoz Marín, later the Puerto Rican governor. Marín rejected both statehood and independence. Greening became exasperated with the Latin statesman and told him, "You can't have your cake and eat it too." Muñoz reported that this was exactly what he wanted, to have his cake and to eat it too. Greening reflected in his autobiography that Governor Muñoz achieved that goal. Puerto Rico became years later a commonwealth, no longer a possession, an island of United States citizens free from many of the responsibilities of citizenship, but free to exercise many of the privileges of citizenship. It was one of the few times Greening, in his autobiography, admits that he was wrong. Nevertheless, the principle Greening enunciated in Puerto Rico and in other United States territories eventually triumphed. Greening had urged that a democracy had no business owning colonies. Greening lived to see his wish come true: self-rule for Puerto Rico, for Hawaii, and for Alaska. In 1936, Greening combined a fact-finding trip to Alaska with a speaking engagement on the University of Alaska campus near Fairbanks. Dr. Earl Beislein recalls the incident.
May of 1936, President Bunnell, the founding president of the university, had invited Mr. Greening to come onto the campus and deliver the commencement address on the 18th of May. Mr. Greening arrived the night before, spent the evening with President Bunnell in his cottage on campus. As his book indicates, it was a rather historical meeting of minds and an opportunity for Mr. Greening to find out a great deal about higher education in the state of Alaska. From this first meeting, Ernest Greening played a fairly important part in the University of Alaska for his great deal of support in his federal offices, in his state offices. And certainly we know that in the years that passed, and because of his work, the Greening Building was named in his memory.
William Cashin tells why this visit was an historic one for the university.
Until that time, I think, I believe it was our 12th commencement, we'd always had some local lawyer or judge or person to give the commencement address. But Dr. Bunnell had been back in Washington, D.C., and he'd met Ernest Greening, who had just been appointed Director of Territories and Island Possessions, and invited him to come up and give our commencement address in 1936. And so he came, and he was a guest of Dr. Bunnell down at the president's cottage. Well, at the time, I was the president's driver. I drove his car. And I was editor of the college newspaper, and so I met Greening right off. I don't remember bringing him to the campus, but I definitely remember taking him back to town to catch the plane. We had Pan American then flying from our little Weeks Field out here to fly to Juneau, and then they would connect in Juneau with a passenger boat to get to Seattle. There was no direct or through flight to Seattle in 36. And so I remember driving him back to town the day after commencement, and he was quite interested to know that I was an Alaskan born and that I was attending the University of Alaska. And he went on to remark how fortunate we young people in Alaska were, because he said he had just been down to Puerto Rico, which was part of his domain, and that he described to me the crowdedness and some of the slum conditions that he saw that the people in Puerto Rico were facing. And he thought that living in Alaska at that time was really one of the fine things, and thought that we were indeed very fortunate to be where we were.
When he returned from Alaska, Greening renewed his campaign to reduce the colonial status for United States territories and possessions. He tried to remove the toll from Alaskan highways. He fought to get a decent hotel built in the best possible location in Mount McKinley National Park. Greening fought against a proposal to place displaced Europeans indiscriminately in Alaska to help populate the territory. Since Greening had fought with Ickes on more home rule for United States territories, he was surprised, he said, when Ickes offered him a post as governor of Alaska. In his book, Greening says he didn't want the post because he knew Alaskans opposed a non-Alaska governor. But Greening recalled that the president talked him into accepting the appointment with these words, "Ernest, Alaska has lost touch with the New Deal. You know what we are trying to do. You know your way around Washington. You know how to get things done. You can do a lot for Alaska. I wish you would make up your mind to take this." The president may have talked Greening into accepting the governor's post, but he didn't talk Alaskans into accepting Greening as governor. The delegate from Alaska, Anthony Diamond, sent the following telegram to the president. Fairbanks, Alaska, August 30, 1939. The President, the White House, Washington, D.C. In event vacancy in office, Governor of Alaska, in common with all other Alaskans and especially the supporters of your policies, earnestly request appointment of resident of Alaska, stop. Appointment of non-resident would be universally opposed in territory and would alienate your most ardent supporters, stop. Within short time, I shall submit names of residents highly qualified for position. That from Anthony J. Diamond, delegate from Alaska. On September 11th, the president replied to Diamond's telegram. The president had not waited for Congress to reconvene. He had appointed Greening during the congressional recess. Diamond sent off a protest to the president, and on November 16th, President Roosevelt wrote to Diamond, "I have received your letter of November 3rd regarding the appointment of Dr. Ernest Greening as governor of Alaska. I am sorry that you felt called upon to make public your protest to me before you had received my answer to your letter. I can understand that you probably must protest the appointment of a non-resident because of local sentiment, but I had hoped that you would not carry your opposition to the Senate. For about 5 years, Dr. Greening has exerted himself in the interest of Alaska, and so far, as his qualifications for the office of governor, he is better qualified by his knowledge of the affairs of the territory and federal administrative procedure than almost any resident. There is no question about the legality of appointing Dr. Greening during the recess of Congress, nor would there be any question about compensating him for his services before confirmation by the Senate. The Secretary of the Interior has satisfied himself on this point by securing an opinion from his solicitor. I see no valid objection by appointing a non-resident so long as the federal government contributes so largely in a financial way to the territory. In this respect, Alaska differs from Hawaii and Puerto Rico, yet even in the case of the latter, it has been customary to appoint a non-resident. I am informed that precedent in Alaska, as a matter of fact, has not established the policy of appointing a resident. I hope that you will not actively oppose my nomination of Dr. Greening when it reaches the Senate, because I feel obliged to appoint him, as I publicly announced some time ago. Very sincerely, Franklin D. Roosevelt." Earlier, the president had sent this reply to Delegate Diamond. "I have received your radiogram of August 30th, in which you urge the appointment of a resident of Alaska to succeed Governor Troy when his resignation becomes effective. By this time, you know, of course, that I have issued a recess commission as governor to Dr. Ernest H. Greening. There is no implication in this appointment of a lack of qualified candidates in Alaska, but I do feel that the administration of the territory is not entirely a local matter. The states have contributed and are contributing a great deal to the development of Alaska, and the interests of all citizens are involved. I think it not only proper, but to the benefit of Alaska, to consider the selection of a governor on the broader basis of special qualifications. There is ample precedent also for appointing a non-resident governor, and I am sure you will agree that some of those men made notable records. Dr. Greening, in his 5 years as Director of the Division of Territories and Island Possessions in the Department of the Interior, has had much to do with affairs of Alaska and has a splendid grasp of the problems and is intensely interested in them. I believe that he will give good account of himself, and I hope that you will give him your full cooperation. Very sincerely, Franklin D. Roosevelt." On December 5, 1939, Greening arrived in Juneau in the midst of a storm, not a natural storm, but a man-made storm. The Juneau newspaper described the scene as follows. The Greenings had hardly reached the bottom of the gangplank when the Democratic office holders herded them back into the social hall of the ship. There a consultation was held, following which the entire group marched off to the territorial building, where inauguration rites were held in the governor's office with only the party leaders present. The mayor, Chamber of Commerce officials, and many others, among them prominent Democrats as well as Republicans, were barred from the inauguration, and there were rumors that Greening was displeased with a welcome. Alaska Link comments on the Juneau newspaper's reaction to Governor Greening.
He didn't have the backing of the papers in Southeastern, or the major paper, I should say, because the Juneau Empire, being Democratic, was very much opposed to some of his legislation and didn't give him any accolades more than they could help.
Another Alaska newspaper, the Anchorage Daily Times, reports that Alaska legislators repeatedly insulted Greening during his tenure and ignored the territorial governor's attempts at social reform. Alaskan artist Rusty Herlin recalls,
"And I was invited to assist him in organizing the Territorial Guard. Went along with Major Marston, who was more or less instrumental in this, and we traveled to 18 villages in the Arctic, and I was very close to the governor, and I remember several things that he did once we went into a bar. I think these are things quite important because to talk about, because he would invite the owner to have a drink with him. He'd go, take him aside, and then he'd say, 'I want you to take that sign down.' The sign read, 'No native trade solicited here.' Well, whether it was a bar or what it was, he was the same in his fairness to the people. And I remember an Eskimo saying, 'We understand that man. He speaks very simply.' And it's just the way that Greening would write. I have many letters from him, and he always wrote in very simple and used beautiful English. Another thing I should say, that while we were traveling, we went to many poor Eskimo villages, and at one place, at particularly Point Lay, we sat down to dinner. He heard that they had very little meat left, and he wouldn't eat. Well, we followed suit because he wouldn't. That's the way he was, very fair in all his doings."
While many of his political enemies remained adamantly opposed, some admired the man they often disagreed with. Alaska Link reminisces.
"I first met Ernest Greening the first day I was in Juneau. I was elected as a representative in 1943. And we flew down late afternoon, got there early evening. The next morning, Jess Landers, who was an early day barber here and also a big Democratic official, had came to me and said, 'Well, the governor would like to make your acquaintance.' And I said, well, fine. I was taken aback because I figured I was very small fry and was very wondering why he was so interested in seeing me the very first day I was down there. I thought, well, this must be something real important. So I went up to visit him, and he was very pleasant to meet. He was most, very, very nice. But everybody kept asking me. In fact, he rather inferred he was trying to feel me out to see whether I was pro-Greening or anti-Greening. He didn't come out and say that as such, but later I found out that the camp in Juneau was bitterly divided. Either you were pro-Greening or you were anti-Greening. I said, 'I'm neither one. I don't even know what you're getting at.' But we had a very short, pleasant conversation, and then of course I met him after the legislature convened. And as it turned out, he was highly political, and he had a pretty smooth machine in Juneau. And I think the old time Junoites were very, they knew this. This was a new kind of politics to them, or maybe it had been going on all the time, and I just didn't know it. But he had his organization very well in operation and took a very active interest in all the legislation went on in the House. Many times he would come down into the hall and buttonhole a legislator on some bill that might be pending or might be coming up for a vote. And it got so that after a while, I didn't like that type of legislation. I mean, I didn't like that type of action. It was politics, but I hadn't realized it at the time. And I figured that he should let a person weigh the pros and cons of a bill and not be pressured or coerced into voting one way or the other for some special particular cause. And so he and I had sort of had a little bit of entanglement over that type of pressure. Despite the fact that we clashed in some types of legislation and in the statehood matter, I did feel and do feel that Governor Greening was probably our most astute governor that we shall see or that we've had in the past. He was highly intelligent, brilliant conversationalist. Fact is, he was an excellent photographer. I once told him that I thought that he'd make a much better photographer than he would pushing statehood for Alaska.
Another political opponent, John Butchervich, remembers Greening perhaps more warmly.
I don't know if I had ever met Ernest Greening until I was elected to the state Senate, but I got acquainted real quickly in 1945 when I went to my first session. And, of course, he'd been governor for since 1939, and one of his many battles had been in progress for quite a while. I was one of two Republicans in the Senate, and I never had the trouble with Governor Greening that many of the Democrats did, because he was an astute enough politician to realize that if he could pick up one of the two Republican votes in the Senate, it was a bonus vote. So we saw quite a bit of each other, and one time I remember I was in bed in the Baranoff Hotel, and the telephone rang, and I answered the phone and said hello, and the voice on the other end said, "This is Ernest." I said, "Ernest who?" He said, "Ernest Greening." I looked at my clock. I said, "Do you know what time it is?" He said, "Yes, it's 1 o'clock." And I said, "Yes, 1 in the morning. He said, "Yes." And I said, "What's cooking?" He said, "I want you to come out to the mansion." I said, "I'm in bed. I got my pajamas on." He said, "That's okay. Slip on your overcoat and call a cab." He said, "I'll turn the light on for you." So I said, "Okay," and called a cab and slipped on my overcoat, went out the mansion, and here he was. He hadn't shaved for 3 or 4 days. He had on his outdoor clothes. He'd just driven in from Eagle River, where he had a summer camp. This was in the middle of the winter during the session. And I walked in, and he said, "Come on in, John, sit down." He says, "There's nobody here." And so I went in, and he said, "Do you like a drink?" And I said, "Sure." So he poured a martini, and we sat down, and he went to work on me, and he was worried that I was going to slip away on a vote the next day. But he didn't have to worry, because I wasn't committed, but I had made up my mind that I was going to stick with him on this particular vote. It concerned the property tax. And that we sat there, and finally I looked out the window, and I said, "It's starting to get light." I said, "I think I better go back to the hotel." So I did. And another time, he was battling for funds for the mansion, and the legislature in those days didn't appropriate very much money. Our total budget for 2 years was less than $6 million the first 2 years I was there. And he had a request in the budget for $1,000 to spend on the mansion, and he wasn't having much luck getting it done. And they always had an annual reception for the legislators, and so everybody in town would go. It was quite an affair, and semi-formal or formal. This particular night, we had an old legislator, a very fine gentleman, Charlie Jones from Nome, and he was at the opposite end of the pole from Ernest philosophically and politically, too. He was a Republican, and he came. He had on his, he always wore four buckle galoshes and great big heavy overcoat, and so he and I went together, and he was quite an elderly man, and we always left our clothes upstairs in the mansion. So we went up the stairs, and there was a straight back chair out in the center of the room, and it seemed kind of strange to me, and the governor said, Ernest said, Senator Jones, sit down here and take off your galoshes. And Charlie walked over, and he sat down in this chair, and when he did, the chair just fell apart in about 100 pieces, and down went Charlie on the floor. And so the next day, Charlie was on the Finance Committee, and we had one member from each of the four judicial divisions, and we got in the committee room, and the first, right off the bat, Charlie said, "That mansion's a disgrace," he said. "We're going to raise that $1,000 to $3,500. And that's what we did. But I thought that was pretty cute, too. And there were a lot of ways to kill a cat, and Ernest was a professional at using them. I served 8 years with Ernest Greening in the Senate when he was governor, and campaigned against him for the Tennessee Plan Senate job, a race in which he defeated me. And I want to say that, personally, I never felt bad about losing to him. I felt honored to be in the same company when we were campaigning, and his passing is a loss to me.